Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody, and thank you very much for the Super Bowl edition of Midrats. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak, and we thank you very much for taking time this afternoon to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you're new to the show and you'd like to catch up on some of your previous shows, or if you just got to go to that Super Bowl party earlier than you wanted to, and you want to catch up on what you missed, you can always catch the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can get the podcast over at iTunes or Stitcher, which is always the most efficient way to do it. But hey, let's go ahead and get on with the show. We're going to have a little bit of fun, but in a serious way here. Because we have something for you navalists out there that we haven't had in quite a while, and that is a new Secretary of the Navy en route. And what we're going to look at is in his role of leading the Navy and Marine Corps in an ongoing decade-and-a-half conflict, along with something that predates the election of President Trump, a mandate, which is followed up with action on Congress, to grow our Navy to 350 ships. An incredible challenge, and he'll be working with somebody who knows the challenge of getting the right things at the right time. He'll be working under the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis. What we're going to do today is we're going to look at what is in that potential, once he gets confirmed, Secretary of the Navy's in basket, from China to Russia to Europe, through the Islamic world, South America, India, all of those spots he's going to have to get very much up to speed with and get ready to corral everybody and keep them focused in the right directions. And we have on today a returning guest that I think is just going to be spot on individual to do a little bit of pontificating with us, and that is going to be James Holmes, Ph.D. Dr. Holmes, he is a professor of strategy and former visiting professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College. He's a former U.S. Navy surface warfare officer and a combat veteran of the First Gulf War, where he was one of our last battleship officers, where he serves as a weapons and engineering officer on the Wisconsin. He was also a firefighting instructor at the Surface Warfare Officer School Command, and he was a military professor of strategy at the Naval War College. He was Phi Beta Kappa, where he received his BA from Vanderbilt University, and he completed his graduate work at Salve Regina University, Providence College, and over at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University is where he received his PhD. His most recent books that he's completed with his longtime co-author and also a prior guest on a few occasions, Toshi Yoshihara, they are Strategy in the Second Nuclear Age and Red Star Over the Pacific. He's published over 25 book chapters and 200 scholarly essays, along with hundreds of scores of columns, think tank analysis, and other work. Jim, welcome back to Midrats.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. It's been too long.
Yes, sir, it sure has. And hey, it's 2017 and we're only in month two. I don't know what happened to the first month, but hey, here we are in the second one. And let's kind of start and set the table with something really basic, because our incoming Secretary of the Navy is not a Navy guy. Now, he's got skin in the game. He has one of his sons is a junior officer and the other one is still at the Naval Academy. But he's not from your classic political background or Navy background. And if we could, let's look at the theory and practice of what a Secretary of the Navy is responsible for. What is he supposed to do? And what are some of the variations of the charter that's given to a Secretary of the Navy that we've seen in the last few people that have held the position?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always good to start basic, especially since we have a rather unconventional type of secretary coming in. Yeah, the Secretary of the Navy, just to oversimplify, would be the person, the civilian official, who essentially keeps the Navy on track with whatever the incoming administration, the administration that's in power, wants it to do. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. It's a question out of civil-military relations for your listeners who are interested in this topic. There's basically two ways to think about civil-military relations. Well, one is sort of the very hands-on, very intrusive model that you would find in the works of our patron saint at the War College, Carl von Clausewitz, who suggests he sort of urges statesmen, political leaders, not to get down into tactical details, but he also suggests that under certain circumstances, when tactics, routine hardware, patrol, if you're in the Army, patrol patterns on counterinsurgency, whatever the case may be, he suggests that it might be warranted for political leaders to get their hands really down into the nitty-gritty. And there's the other, model that we associate mostly with Sun Tzu, the ancient Chinese general, who suggests that there are circumstances in which the general should ignore orders from the sovereign if the sovereign doesn't know what's going on the battlefield. The United States has clearly inclined towards the intrusive model. That's the way I tend to go myself. But in any event, so he's basically keeps the military under civilian authority. Interestingly, my wife is now a naval person as well. She joined us at the War College a couple of years ago and didn't seem quite clear on what the secretary does, as opposed to the chief of naval operations, whom we normally think about as the face of the U.S. Navy. I'm not sure if it's a misconception. We tend to think that the secretary may have a hand in making and executing strategy, which is not really necessarily the case. And I have no idea what the administration was thinking when it chose the current secretary over Randy Forbes, who everybody thought it was going to get it. But Forbes is very much a maritime strategist and very knowledgeable in that. So perhaps the administration deliberately picked somebody who didn't have that pedigree so that it could go another way with the Navy over the next 4 to 8 years.
And he's also following on, and I kind of touched on this in the intro, that he follows on his predecessor, Secretary of the Navy Mavis, who was a political animal, former governor of Mississippi, which has no small maritime influence with construction and industry. So he came with that knowledge ahead of time. And plus he was a JO, not that that really takes much. But he was in there for a very long time, a long tenure. He was very active. And in any turnover you get, if you're lucky, your predecessor will have, if not fixed some problems, have done a pretty good job in securing a few areas. So when you go in, you can address your attentions to those areas that you really feel that you need to. When you look at the very long tenure that Secretary Mavis was there and all the things that he left his impression on, are there some things you think stand out that Secretary of the Navy Mavis did that will help his relief, get his footing and move forward on those topics that are more important to the new administration?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's always hard for an outsider. I mean, I consider myself a relative outsider, even though I work for the Navy. But it's always hard to know how much to attribute to any single decision maker. But I mean, some of the big things that did happen under his tenure that were very good were, for example, just basic stuff like getting our minds back on shipbuilding, getting our minds back on war at sea. Starting to take China seriously. I'm a China guy, so I think about that a lot. It wasn't when Secretary Mavis came in 2009, we were still in the mode where we didn't really think too much that China could accomplish very much, and we've seen that turn around. We've seen ourselves start, in part because of China and Russia, to take the need to get long-range anti-ship munitions back out to the fleet where they have not been for a long time. I mean, there's a lot of getting back to basics, I think, would be something that you would mark as a hallmark of Secretary Mavis's tenure. And I think that's a basic area that he's left the incoming administration in good shape on. You can quarrel with Secretary Mavis on social issues, on the Great Green, the biofuels initiative and all that kind of stuff, but you certainly have to give him his due on as far as getting back to basic functions like sea combat.
when I was a young officer, I had a captain who said, when you take command, you should do one of two things. If they are ringing bells at, you know, eight bells at noon or whatever, then you should tell them to stop. And if they're not doing it, you should tell them to start, to let everybody know that there's a new boss. If you were telling the incoming secretary one thing he should do to let everybody know there's a new boss, what would you suggest to him?
Wow, so you're saying that you should just do something sort of dramatic in order to announce your presence. Isn't that interesting? Moving aggressively to start building the 350 ship or 355 ship, whatever it ends up being, building that number into the public consciousness and starting to prepare the way. I mean, that's a fairly significant thing just for budgetary reasons, and I think that he needs to start to acclimate not only the Navy but also to help acclimate the population to basically putting out more resources for the Navy, mainly to explain why the Navy is important, But anyway, so that's just, I guess that's sort of my off the cuff remark on that. Yeah, do something to announce your presence. Interesting.
And one thing the new Secretary of the Navy brings is he comes from a business background, overseas business background nonetheless, and he's coming from that environment that he has objectively been very successful at. And he's coming to the very Byzantine environment and bureaucracy of the Pentagon, Capitol Hill, and industry. What are some of those things you think he needs to quickly get up to speed with when it comes to the culture change that he's going to encounter trying to get things accomplished? And as he builds up his team, are there certain areas and skill sets that you think he should look at when he wants to get people with the right background and the right mindset that'll help him bridge and adjust to the new work environment he has?
Yeah, you pointed out that he has a very unusual background, as we've heard a lot in the commentary over the selection. Not only a business background, but he's very much a China hand. Spent, I believe, about 20 years working in China, in Hong Kong. So he's and there may have been some signaling involved with that when he was selected. But yeah, so certainly coming from a very different background. As far as the basics of how to bridge from that environment to a more bureaucratic environment like the Navy, man, I mean, it certainly would be nice if he read up or consulted with people who talk about organizational culture, how big bureaucratic institutions like the Navy or the military or really any big organization do things, because it's you simply can't do what you might be able to do in the business world and basically order that something be done and expect it to be done in an expeditious manner. Bureaucracies do not necessarily work that way. So as far as the basics, I think getting up to speed on that would be very helpful. To supplement his expertise with people who might be able to help out with this transition, I would think that he should probably look to some long-timers, whether it's in the think tank world, consult with the Brian McGraths of the world or so forth, people like such as yourselves who are operators and who know how the organization operates. That doesn't mean necessarily that it has to always operate that way, but at least that would give him a good starting point as he starts to think ahead and build this 355-ship Navy or whatever it might be, and face off against our adversaries.
One of the you had an article, I think it was in National Interest, if I'm not mistaken, but wherever it was on the need for the new SecNav to kind of set a different cultural or focus on the Navy's culture. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure, Mark. It was actually a lighthearted piece. So sometimes you know how it is when you're sitting around on a Friday afternoon late and you're the last people in. You'll have silly conversations. My office mate asked me what I would do if I were sort of an all power, you know, sort of a variation of the old if I were a king for the day, if I were Secretary of the Navy and could change one thing about the Navy in a day. And I said, I kind of finessed the answer. I said that it would change the culture. And what I mean by that is if we get the attitudes of the people in the service, if their attitudes are right, a whole lot of things will start falling into place. And I, for lack of a better list of things, I said I would like to change the culture in three ways, or at least cement movement in the right direction in three ways. First of all, I said that the Navy should be very fatalistic about its profession. And what I mean by that is we should have a sort of a tragic sense of what our profession is all about. You guys were in the service at the same time I was, and we remember in 1992 when the top Navy leadership issued from the sea its first post-Cold War directive as to how we were going to do things strategically in the post-Cold War world. And the preamble to that document declared that since the Soviet Navy was now gone, we had no one else to fight, and that we could thus turn our attentions almost entirely to projecting power from the sea. And I think that the Navy took them at their word, and I think that's one of the major reasons that we let things basic functions like surface warfare, anti-submarine warfare, all these basic things go. And I think that's one reason that we're scrambling to catch up today. So I would say never ever should we ever delude ourselves that history has ended the way we did back then. The second aspect was that, and I forget exactly what term I hung on it, but it was basically that we should take an experimental mindset. That we should, rather than doing the sorts of things that we saw in the early 2000s with the littoral combat ship, with F-35, whatever the case may be, the Ford class carrier to an extent, rather than coming up with a great idea, saying that we have all these great ideas and we're going to pile them onto a hull and order 55 of them in the case of the LCS. I think that's a deeply flawed way of to go about experimentation and upgrading of naval platforms. We have to be more committed to constant incremental tinkering with platforms rather than trying to make these leaps ahead. You might get away with one or two leaps ahead on a given hull, but the chances are, as you compound that, as you multiply those innovations, chances are you're going to compound your chances of failure. And lastly, I reached for the world of philosophy. One of my favorite philosophers is really an American original. If you've ever read The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, Eric Hoffer was part of that whole migration out to California during the days of the Dust Bowl, and he worked as a longshoreman in San Francisco and made himself into one of the best philosophers in American history, in my view. One of his books, it's not his best known book, but his best known book is The True Believer, which is something we read a lot when we think about counterinsurgency. But he wrote another book, which he thought it was his best, called The Ordeal of Change. And he goes into all the reasons why it's hard to change as individuals, as organizations, and so forth. And one of his chief findings out of the book, so it's a nice short book, about 100 pages long, one of his chief findings is that innovative ages tend to be upbeat ages. They tend to be joyful ages. He recalls ancient Athens during the age of Pericles and when the Parthenon's constructed and all that kind of stuff. He talks about Great Britain and during the Restoration phase in the 17th century. He talks about the European Renaissance. These were all sort of upbeat, bubbly eras in which people were basically free to tinker without worrying too much about orthodoxy clamping down on them. And he thinks that's a good thing. So the new secretary and his leadership should look for ways to encourage that, to essentially not be control freaks clamping down on junior personnel and so forth. If we can make innovation fun, I think we're going to get a whole lot more out of it. So I would certainly be looking for ways to do that.
Well, you've got my endorsement on your top three. we'll translate it to Latin and put it on a patch. I think what goes into that as well, and I want to pontificate for a second if you'll indulge me.
Sure.
Because, people is policy, and it's important that we don't just get people of the right background that we think, but we also get people that have personalities that you just can't find in the record. We need a little more humility in what we do, too, and some of the issues that you brought up, which are not the way to do things. A lot of those problems derive from the fact, to be blunt, we as an institution allowed ourselves to be arrogant. We did not allow our decisions to be tempered by the hard mistress of experience and centuries of experience of making navies work. So, yeah, I would tack a number four on there is we need to get people not only that have a little bit of fatalistic experimental mindset and don't cut off heads and put it on pikes, but also people that will humble. I think that's a nice way to do it. I wanted to go back and just let me mention the folks that are live, because I don't think I did at the intro. If you're with us live, if you scroll down near the bottom of the show page, that's where we have the chat room. And if you have some questions or observations during the course of the show, that's a great place to do it. And if you have questions that you would like for us to address to our guest, that's a great place to put it as well, because we'll steal it. And Jerry Hendricks asked a question in the showroom that I think folds in well with one of my questions I brought in earlier, because we talked about Mabus a bit. But when you look at some of the more recent secretaries in the Navy, just to mention a few of them, you have the SecNav's Mabus, England, and Lehman, very different characters with different skill sets that they brought in. Which one of those do you think is most representative of the modern SecNav?
Oh my gosh! Well, that's actually kind of hard to say. But you know, Lehman would probably be my favorite one out of that list. But he was the one who bucked the point that I made earlier about secretaries not necessarily being maritime strategists. He was definitely somebody who came in and thought of himself as essentially reawakening the Mahanian model of how to do war at sea. Whether it's with this 82-86 maritime strategy and outflanking the Soviets around their periphery and so on and so forth. So he was very effective, partly because because of his force of character and so on and so forth. But I would describe, I think that is probably the outlier among secretaries if you look back over the sweep of history. Probably the as far as who is the most representative of the particular functions of the secretary. Probably Gordon England. I mean, it's somebody who's a real caretaker over the department, who has a pretty good mastery of how it operates, how budgets work, and so on and so forth. Sort of an establishment man type who can implement the wishes of the political administration that's in power. But anyway, just to go back to our earlier discussion, I think we might see this particular secretary carve out a different model, since he does seem to be not only a businessman but also a regional expert, has a lot of regional expertise that even a lot of us probably don't have. So we might be starting to see the advent of a new model, and that'll be something to watch in the coming years.
Well, we seem to have wandered off every now and then in the Navy to go into politically correct stuff and not necessarily focus on the mission of the Navy. Is it given this business background and the way I understand business, and only having worked in it for a few decades, will there, you think, be less focus on that? On that side of the coin and on the political correct side, and more focus on let's get the mission done, then we can worry about the other stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, as far as wandering off message and getting into social issues and so on and so forth, I would say that's almost a foregone conclusion, not just because we have a new secretary, but because of who the secretary is working for. I think President Trump is President Trump because he ran on to trying to get away from that and trying to downplay that sort of thing. So I would certainly expect to see that de-emphasized, even though I noticed that a lot of the trainings that put in place under Secretary Mabus are still going on. But again, we're still just a couple of weeks in, so we will see. But I would certainly expect to see that stuff go on the back burner. Maybe it doesn't disappear entirely, but I doubt it will get the sort of focus that it has over the last 8 years. When you talk about cultures wandering off message, there's actually a book recommendation. Every week I send out an email blast to my seminars and make what I call extraneous book recommendations, things that are not in our syllabus and they're not required to read, but I think they're really, really important. The CNO, back when he was commanding the submarine force, certainly before he was CNO, actually paid out of his own pocket to have a book put back in print through the Naval Institute, and it's Andrew Gordon's book, The Rules of the Game. I got it just thinking that I would scan it just to be in tune with the leadership and so forth, so on and so forth. I ended up reading this entire thing. It's about 700 pages long, closely, and taking copious notes. What it is, it's a history of the battle of Jutland. And the question he raises is that at various points in that battle, the commanders of the various battleship and battlecruiser squadrons ended up being rather rigid and not doing things on their own personal initiative. And he asks why. I mean, why did they do these things that cost the Royal Navy dearly in the terms of 6,000 lives and so on and so forth. So he goes back. He goes all the way back to the Battle of Trafalgar, and which of course was Nelson's great victory over a Franco-Spanish fleet off the south coast of Spain. And he says, and he basically makes a strong claim. There's basically a century of peace after Trafalgar, after that great victory, that in which the Royal Navy does very little. In fact, it fights no fleet engagements during the entire 19th century. It does a lot of imperial police wars. It obviously upholds trade and so on and so forth throughout the empire. But it gets out of the habit. It gets out of the habit of sea combat against a peer adversary. And what happens if, in Gordon's telling, is that the Royal Navy hierarchy basically becomes a bunch of control freaks. They're able to obsess over administrative details, bookkeeping, and so on and so forth. In the tactical sense, they put in place the flag signals, the flag signal system that is extremely elaborate, and that it appeared to some people in the Royal Navy would not actually work. But I mean, for the simple reason that once you move from sail to steam, you have to think about the battlefield or the area of the combat being cluttered up with smoke, cluttered up with all manner of things. So he spends a lot of time getting into how that culture grew up and how this long calm lee of Trafalgar, as Gordon calls it, really left the Royal Navy put in a bad position going into Jutland in 1916, which of course we commemorated the centennial of last year. Just one quick anecdote before we get back to the subject matter at hand. The thing that really struck me wasn't Jutland. He actually goes in 1893. There's an admiral by the name of George Tryon, Vice Admiral Tryon, in command of the Mediterranean Fleet, which essentially was the experimental fleet for the Royal Navy. And it appeared that he was having mental problems or something like that, but he was an advocate of personal initiative. He had introduced what they called the TA system, Tango Alpha Signal, that would liberate individual squadron commanders to support the flagship, but act on their own initiative. So in 1893, he's actually maneuvering the squadron, and he's been maneuvering the Mediterranean fleet to go to anchorage, and the fleet is in two columns parallel. He wants to reverse course and go to anchorage. So he sends an order for those two columns to turn towards each other, which to me seems like a kind of a hair-raising thing to do just for a routine evolution. But the key point was that they knew what the tactical turning rate is, that the tactical diameter of those ships were, and they were within it. But nonetheless, he's in the battleship Victoria leading one column. Another, his fellow commander is in the battleship Camperdown leading the other column, and that guy executes the signal even though he knows what's going to happen. And guess what happens? There's a collision. The flagship sinks. Tryon is killed, and his whole system of individual initiative is discredited, even though it wasn't in force at the time of the accident. So basically, even though he goes down with the ship, he takes his doctrine with him, and that leaves the Royal Navy in this very centralized, rigid mindset all the way up until it doesn't work out at Jutland, rather. And at that point, they start to liberalize and become more flexible. But in any event, Admiral Richardson thinks that idea of a long calm lee of Trafalgar might have its analogy in the long calm lee that we're in today, which of course would date to 1944 and the Battle of Leyte Gulf. And he thinks it's almost a subversive work, and I think that's one reason he wants us to read it. And I certainly would add my voice to that, having waded through it.
Absolutely, and plus, for Jim, it's got lots of battleships in it. So, what more can you ask for?
Yeah, of course, there's all the fun historical details as well, such as the debate between battleships and battlecruisers, and all that stuff that you're familiar with from the history books. He retells all that stuff, but to me, the stuff about organizational culture is really the important point.
Absolutely, you can have all the equipment in the world, but if you don't have the right organizational culture and leadership structure, it's all just good for parade. Let's talk about Jim for a little while. You spent a lot of time thinking about China, thinking about Westpac. And one thing the Secretary of the Navy is going to have coming across his desk is the fact that some of the more important players that are either allies or used to be allies or used to be enemies and want to be allies have been in the news recently to one degree or another. And we'd be interested to see what you think would be good steps the SECNAV could do to address a few things. First of all, our relationship with Australia. There's been a little bit of kerfuffle at the political level recently on that, but we continue to address the importance of that location with the Marines in the last few years going in and out of Darwin. Taiwan has definitely broken above the ambient noise, and there's a few different things that we can do with Taiwan with what it seems to be the new administration's view on them. Vietnam's been a little quiet, but that, I think that's one of the – it's not undertold. People have talked about it a lot, but I think one of the real positive notes of the last real decade plus is how Vietnam and the U.S. have begun to get closer and closer. And those are all quasi-good stories for us, comma. But to balance that off, there is also the very weird sideshow going on in the Philippines. So what do you think of the periphery of China and the new SECNAV and some of those countries and their relationship to us?
Yeah, I mean, that's we obviously spend a lot of time thinking about the South China Sea these days just because China has, it appears to me, is determined to dismantle the law of the sea, dismantle freedom of the sea in the waters next to its shores, between especially that, but also the East China Sea. And I think the I'm not sure exactly to what degree it's in the Secretary's gift to actually do this, but certainly the administration as a whole does need to tend to our alliances. And I'll actually start with the one that you listed last, the Philippines. I would be far from describing that as a sideshow, simply because of where the Philippines sits and the uses that we can make out of it. If you scoop all the way back to the World War II, immediate post-World War II era, as we started thinking about containing the communist world, especially the Soviet Union, but also China as well, U.S. decision makers such as General MacArthur, who was in charge in Japan, and then Secretary of State Dean Acheson, they saw the first island chain, what the Chinese call the first island chain, that immediate offshore line of islands from Japan through Taiwan, through the Philippines, and then, depending on how you trace it, even all the way around to Singapore. They saw that as the way to inhibit maritime movement east-west from Asia into the Western Pacific and also north-south up and down the eastern seaboard. And the Chinese are always accusing us of still containing it to this day. I don't really think that's true, but it is certainly true that U.S. allies inhabit that entire island chain all the way up and down. If the Philippines is actually going to do is actually serious what President Duterte says he's serious about, which is to call into question the alliance system that's been in the place between ourselves and the Philippines since 1951. If you think about what that actually does, if we do not have military access to the Philippines, or if he cozies up to the Chinese, which he has done to a certain extent already, that really blows a hole in that defense perimeter, in that containment perimeter. It also denies the United States, the U.S. forces, a position from which to reach certain battlegrounds in the South China Sea if things do go hot between ourselves and China. And that's with this audience, I'm sure you immediately grasp that. If you don't have a strategic position in the South China Sea, it's really, really hard to go in against the home team, which is what China is, and mount a presence of serious staying power. If you think about what the logistics, basically, if that happened, the United States would have to, the U.S. Navy would have to bring all its stuff, all its stores, all its ammunition, all its fuel, and so forth, to the scene, and rely on the logistics fleet to get that stuff into the theater. If it's coming from Australia, it's obviously coming from outside the South China Sea. That would be one possibility. If it's coming from Japan, that's even more problematic because that would mean that those CLF ships are passing up and down the Chinese seaboard within reach of Chinese shore-based weaponry as well as the fleet. So that's if you lose the Philippines, that's really, I hate to use the term game changer, which is vastly overused, but I think it certainly changes the terms of the debate and it makes it a whole lot harder for the United States to uphold freedom of the sea in that sea as as the 2015, for example, Asia-Pacific Maritime Strategy said we were gonna. So I think that is something that I hope the administration will pay close attention to. As far as the other cats and dogs, of course, Secretary Mattis, General Mattis, is in Japan now, trying to. Apparently, he did rather well. There was an article from Robert Burns in the Associated Press today, basically saying he was treated like a rock star. One has to imagine that having a general in charge of your foreign policy is something that would resonate with Japan, given their experience with General MacArthur right after World War II, who was a revered figure to this day, as well as their experience with Admiral Arleigh Burke, whom you could reasonably call the father of the Japan Maritime Self Defense Force. So that seems to have worked out rather well. Don't know if that was deliberate, but it did work out rather well. As far as Australia, it did seem like the president may have committed an unforced error getting into a tussle with the prime minister over immigration policy. Not sure exactly what the truth of that was, but yes, there was certainly a kerfuffle over that. If you don't have access to the Philippines, I mean, what are the alternatives? Kind of hard to the Vietnamese, obviously, as you mentioned, are much more receptive to having closer military and political ties and economic ties with the United States. But how far does that extend? Does that extend to opening Cameron Bay to the U.S.? I think that would be a pretty high wall to climb. But we'll have to see. Singapore, I have a very hard time seeing them let us base warfighting forces there, simply because of their status as a little power in a very tough neighborhood. And you mentioned Taiwan. Yeah, Taiwan that's been fascinating to watch. I'm not exactly sure what to make out of Taiwan. I was doing a radio spot in New York City a few weeks ago, right after President Trump tweeted out that he was calling the One China principle into question. And the host asked me. He said, "What do you think about this?" And I said, "I don't know what I think about it. I know what I feel about it. I feel great. It makes me want to pump my fist because somebody has taken the initiative from China." Whether that translates into a willingness to do more provocative things that we haven't done since like the 1970s, like have military exercises with the Taiwanese, or whatever the case may be, I don't know. I mean, President Trump is quite clearly a change agent, but that's a major step to take, and we'll see whether that actually pays out in concrete terms, or whether it's the start of some sort of. We know that he's a deal maker, and this might be the start of some sort of negotiating strategy. But yes, I would have a hard time seeing or using Taiwan as a geostrategic asset in the South China Sea. But yeah, certainly alliances is something that we need to firm up and keep those firm. And yeah, President Duterte again, he's almost a one man wrecking crew who could bring the whole thing down.
Eagle One.
Is this thing on?
Yeah, what? No, it's me. it's that ONOFF switch again, you know. I thumb it one way and I'm on and I'm anyway. I'm looking at those island chains and I'm thinking, you know, we got Guam, and if it doesn't tip over and because we're going to put all the Marines on there and sink, we still, you know, I don't know what our relationship is with the Northern Marianas, but we got Wake, we got Midway, we got all these other islands out there that. Theoretically, would give us at least, if we could get through the environmental concerns, would give us additional hard aircraft carriers, if you will, or places to put stuff. Are they just too far away to be influencers in the South China Sea? I mean, we're already using Guam pretty heavily, so is that just out of the question?
Well, I mean, it's not out of the question, but I mean, if you look at the map, the first island chain, depending on the latitude, runs between Taiwan, its closest point is only 90 miles offshore. I think the farthest offshore Japan gets from continental Asia is about 500 miles. But if you go out to the second island chain, which runs from northern Japan through, as you mentioned, Guam, which is the midpoint, and on down to New Guinea, Guam's about 1,500 miles offshore. That's which is, as we know. And sort of bridging back to where we started off this discussion about letting things go in the 1990s, range is one of the things that we have let go. So it's, I mean, as far as aircraft and so on and so forth, it's, you can't really access the South China Sea very easily from there, and you certainly can't sustain a presence very easily from there, which is one reason that I guess one of the other things that we should be, and I certainly hope we're looking at as we think about the configuration of this 355 ship Navy is exactly how many CLF, combat logistics fleet ships, are we going to have in there, because if we do get locked out of some of our allies' territory, we're going to be relying heavily on those things. And the fleet looks pretty lean to me with I believe 31 vessels to cover the entire seven seas. But yeah, certainly we will still have geographic assets at our disposal. But and it's really hard to sustain a warfighting endeavor in the South China Sea from there. The Australians are much closer, but again, China is their largest trading partner, and they obviously do not have a lot of appetite for getting involved in this. Are they there? Yes, but I don't think it'll be a very easy decision for them to make, and they might not line up behind U.S. strategy the way we've expected in the past.
When you look at the building program the Chinese Navy is going through, and just an interesting anecdote, last summer I actually had a dinner guest at my house she's Chinese national. Was here as part of a large organization, and in the course of a conversation about her husband is a senior lieutenant in the Chinese Navy, and Mrs. Salamander and her started telling Navy wife stories. It's funny. It doesn't matter whether you're in the U.S. Navy or the Chinese Navy; it's all the same. Anyway, I think she's a spy, just kidding. It was very fun to listen to, and it's got to be an exciting time for her husband too. He's a senior lieutenant in a Navy that's growing strong. And there's actually been a few articles in the last month talking about the Chinese 500 ship Navy, and it's good. Numbers matter. It's good that we're talking, pushing, and planning towards 350. But one thing that keeps coming to mind for me, and they're tied together. First of all, there's interior and exterior lines of communication. Let's go to operational planning 1-on-1. We are a global Navy with a global presence. We're a two-ocean Navy. Being able to concentrate forces for us is a lot different than the Chinese, especially if they don't have quite the same global desires we want to. There's a numbers issue, and the quality issue is starting to creep up as well. But on the other side of the equation, there's something that also in history has a tendency to catch established powers off balance against rising powers who they hold in some cultural contempt. I'm thinking, of course, one of the classic examples from over a century ago was the Imperial Russian versus the Imperial Japanese Navy. And there have been recent statements about the Chinese Navy can't fight its way out of a wet paper bag. And yes, they're commissioning new destroyers that are the height of late 70s technology. I think people could argue both sides of that equation. But for a new SECNAV, how does he balance and inform himself about those two things, a strong, rising, improving Chinese Navy from a numbers and a spreadsheet point of view, combined with in certain parts of our national defense infrastructure, a little bit of lack of respect for the Chinese from a quality and a performance point of view?
Yeah, I think I'll go straight to the last point. You raised several good points there about the geography, about a global power such as ourselves having to manage multiple theaters. It's as you point out, it's really really painful for us to concentrate the fleet in the Western Pacific simply because that means we'll be perhaps not altogether leaving uncovered our interests in the Mediterranean and the Middle East and so on and so forth. But yes, it's certainly a painful thing for us to do and a risky thing for us to do considering our global commitments. China has the luxury of committing its entire fleet where it matters most, which is in the China Seas, and it's not that easy for us to make the decision to do that unless things get really bad. So that's sort of an attitude that I would like to see the Secretary and his lieutenants try to implant as they come into power. As far as that's one of my I hate to say talking points. It's one of my standard points to make is that it is really, really dangerous. It's really dangerous to have contempt towards a rising power just because of what that power was in the past. I think there was an image of China's navy all the way back from Mao in the 1950s that has lingered with us, where basically the Chinese navy was nothing more than a coastal defense force that was supposed to hold outside aggressors at bay. We didn't try to do wider sea denial, didn't try to command the seas or anything like that. And I think that it seems like it's taken us some time to come to. Yeah, that phrase, I can't even remember who that was, but that crack about the Chinese Navy not being able to fight its way out of a wet paper bag, I think that was probably the worst example of that I've heard in a very long time. There's a way to bring history to bear on this question and try to counteract attitudes like that. If you Toshi, whom you mentioned earlier, he and I have been writing together since 1998, on and off, more on than off, I guess. I guess if you scope back, we got tired of hearing this sort of thing a few years ago, so we decided to look at some cases from scoping back into the 19th century in which a rising power set out to build a navy to contend with a dominant power, and. It sounds a little bit like numerology, but we sort of came up. We said it seems like it takes about 15 years to put out a serious regional navy, and it takes about 30 years if you're steadfast about the effort to put out a blue water fleet. We looked at ourselves, the United States, which laid down its first armored, steam-driven, big-gun battle fleet in 1883, crushed the Spanish 15 years later, and ultimately by the end of World War I. Had become a navy second to none, as codified in the Naval Arms Accords. If you look at Japan came out of seclusion in the late 1860s after a couple of centuries, 250 years or thereabouts, of seclusion from the outside world. Decided to become modern. Decided to become industrial in the 1870s. By the 1890s, it defeats China's navy, which is the foremost navy in Asia, indigenous navy in Asia. And does so in a rather impressive fashion. And as you mentioned, the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 1905, they come back a decade later and they crush the Russians, basically put it into Russian sea power in the Far East until the days of Admiral Gorshkov after the Second World War. So, you can go on. You could talk about Imperial Germany, which loses but gives, again, back to Jutland, it gives Great Britain fits. The Germans, they started in 1898. By 1916, they're able to put out a force that qualitatively can hold its own against the Royal Navy. If you had given them 15 more years, who knows what might have happened if World War One had never transpired. So you get the point. I mean, it is each one of these powers either was able to win in the case of the United States, or it was able to give the dominant power fits in the case of Imperial Germany, Imperial Japan, and the Soviet Union. And we actually don't know for sure exactly how that how a fight between ourselves and the Soviets would have come out, but they did it even faster than Japan and Germany. So it's very dangerous attitude to, simply because we've been the established power for a long time, to assume that it's always going to be that way. We should never project the past and the future, because as philosophers tell us, then black swans are going to come along and bite us in the rear end, to mix metaphors.
I just finished reading Kaplan's Asia's Cauldron, in which you and Toshi are mentioned, by the way. I think his conclusion is that we're just going to have to kind of live with China's thing. He doesn't see China as being necessarily an aggressive, want to take over the world thing, but they do want to claim, as I call it, their hinterlands, that blue sea, the South China Sea, is as part of their internal area. Is he right on that? Are they not that aggressive, or is this a matter of self preservation for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Bob's a friend of mine and has been for some years, and he's done a lot for us. But once in a while, he says something that I actually went after him on this point when that book appeared, I believe back in 2014, because I think it's his opinion he draws out of this is rather dangerous. I guess there's two points. First of all, he talks about the Monroe Doctrine. Let me scoot back through our history, and then I'll come to the territory point. He points out that, especially under the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt, the United States, under the Monroe Doctrine, evolved from basically seeing itself as a joint defender of American independence writ large, all the American states from European rule, into claiming certain special prerogatives for itself. Under Roosevelt, the United States claimed the right to intervene in Latin American states if they were having difficulties repaying their debts to European states. That mattered because European states had a bad habit of sending the fleet to seized territory in the Americas to repay their creditors when that sort of thing happened. Roosevelt, Alfred Thayer Mahan, obviously one of our patron saints, these guys really worried that that the Europeans would seize these cases as a pretext to come over and build naval bases in the Caribbean Sea and the Gulf of Mexico that would threaten the communications with the Panama Canal once that thing was finished. And Bob says, well, you know, Kaplan says basically the Chinese are doing the same thing and that we had better come to terms with that. To which I would say the Chinese are going far, far beyond anything the U.S. ever did in the 19th or 20th centuries or ever, really. The Chinese are basically, and this bridges into the second point that you made, the Chinese actually seem to see the sea as territory to be occupied and sovereignty exercised there. The United States never claimed to, it never sketched a nine-dash line around the Caribbean or the Gulf of Mexico. It certainly never claimed the islands or the sea or the airspace as territory, which is what China is apparently trying to do. All the way back to 2009 when it submitted its map with the nine-dash line, essentially claiming what it calls indisputable or sometimes irrefutable sovereignty over the islands, the waters, and the skies within that 80 to 90% of the South China Sea. So that's, if you think about what sovereignty is, all the way back to your International Relations 101, sovereignty means nothing but physical control of space within borders on the map. And this is where I think Robert Kaplan gets it wrong. This is something of a, it may be a manifestation of the same habits of thinking about offshore waters, but it's definitely at a much higher degree than anything that the United States ever did. And if you disbelieve me, I mean, you can look at what the United States ultimately did with the Monroe Doctrine. In the 1920s, the State Department actually disavowed the Monroe Doctrine and gave up on whatever excessive claims it had had. And this gave way, of course, under President Hoover and then Franklin Roosevelt to the inter-American system that we know today. Can you imagine China doing that sort of thing with its neighbors, 5-10 years from now? And if you can't, I think we're in the presence of new territory. I love Bob's works. I agree with him about 95% of the time, but the other 5%, I think he really gets something wrong.
Now let's touch on for a little bit the not very fun part of the SECNAV's job. But one actually with the incoming SECNAV might surprise us and be pretty good at. That has to do with the budget wars. He's going to have in his back pocket a charter to work to 350. That takes money over long periods of time. And there are two ways of getting money. Well, three ways. You can have an overall increase of the defense budget where the rising tide raises all boats. You can put a percentage chance on that. I won't. I need more money, so I'm going to take it from you, which anybody that has siblings know that usually results in some bad stuff. You take people off other people's plate. And then they're simply reprioritizing what rice you have in your own bowl. And there are two ways of looking at that. Traditionally, and this may sound judgmental, but that's okay, there is a punt, the salami slices. Okay, we have to cut X amount of money, so everybody's going to have to give me Y percent of your wedge of the pie. Everybody takes a little salami slice. There's other something that takes a little more grit. That's taking wedges, where you go, you know what? I know this is important. I know this is nice, but I need that $2.3 billion. We're going to have to put that in our acceptable risk category. What are your thoughts with the incoming Secretary of the Navy as he maybe tries to fight for one or two, but hope for the best, plan for the worst, and the worst is he's going to have to grow that fleet internally. What are some wedges he might want to look at to eliminate that could free up a few shekels?
Oh wow, that's a big question. I'm probably not actually the right one to ask, but yeah, well, no, I know. Yeah, that's a, You see, that's why I'm dodging the question. But no, you're absolutely right. I think your point was that we can either get more money for the defense budget, try to steal it from the other services, or try to reapportion within the U.S. Navy's budget and go from there. Yeah, I think that's basically a way to look at it. Just a historical case that you might that the listeners might enjoy looking back at. If you look after the Second World War, which is obviously one of our historical markers as a service. Sam Huntington of Harvard published an article in the Naval Institute Proceedings in 1954, contending that the Navy had won too big. It had crushed the German Navy. It had crushed the Japanese Navy. Nobody was really left to oppose U.S. maritime supremacy. And this happened at the same time that you had the U.S. Air Force striving for a bigger budget share, simply because it had planes to drop the nukes. And this brand new instrument of war, and the Navy didn't at the time. And there's a lot of flailing around. There's what we call the revolt of the admirals. You had a similar sort of debate that we might be seeing shape up in Washington today as the Trump people take office. So that's something that's worth revisiting. This might actually go back to your initial question about U.S. naval culture, the ability to explain to people who don't do sea power every day why sea power is important is certainly an important function that. That any Secretary of the Navy should try to cultivate, because if you go down to Atlanta or somewhere like that, far from the sea, people simply don't think about the Navy and the contributions that it makes to national security. Instead of speculating about what's going to happen with the budget, why don't we take your last option and say what could we reapportion it around within the Navy to try to grow the Navy by basically shifting money around. It is possible that one thing that drives me nuts is our inability to buy foreign. If you wanted to add submarines to the U.S. submarine fleet, for example, why can we not buy Japanese? Basically, it's always struck me that it would be a logical thing if we want to further consolidate our relationship with Japan. What better would be than to basically have a forward combined submarine fleet of Japanese Soyuz permanently stationed in Japan along that first island chain, where it could provide a lot of bang for the buck, be a token of U.S. presence in the Far East that's unbreakable, and on and on. And you can do that relatively inexpensively. I haven't looked at the figures in a couple of years, but it used to be on. You used to be able to get about five Soyuz for the price of one U.S. Virginia class nuclear attack boat, and that suggests that you can get a lot of bang for the buck on that. I know you're always on about buying foreign as far as frigates. I'm all about that as well. There's some very good platforms out there that you might be able to substitute out for if you were to cut the buy of literal combat ships at some point, 28 or whatever the number of hulls might be. That might be the next thing to come along. Whether we buy them overseas, build them here at home, which would be the more likely aspect given the politics of it. But in some way, I think we have to figure out a way to get low-cost platforms into the fleet, and that need not be from our own shipyards. I think we should we expect our allies to buy our stuff, and I think we should be willing to make the same sort of change up.
Yeah, one of the things I've been fascinated by is they're looking at everybody acknowledges the military, all parts of the services, except maybe the F-22s, have all been rode hard and hung up wet, and we've really got to maintain and maybe even refurbish dramatically the fleet we have. Is the prioritization that we need to get the Army and the Marine Corps and the Navy and the Air Force up to speed and then worry about growth, or can we do both?
Yeah, I think you're sounding. I mean, you sound like General Mattis, who came out with a. It's not a very detailed plan, but it's a good statement of principles, and that's what he basically says. First things first, let's maintain the fleet that we have, and then we'll start thinking about. It's basically a phased thing where you would take care of maintenance, where you would restock munitions and so forth. Get the fleet the fleet and the military that we have back up to speed, and then think about expanding to whatever size that it. The administration deems is worthwhile and affordable. But yeah, it's actually Sal. Sal had a really good post a week or two ago in which he referred to one of my favorite cases, the Russo-Japanese War, in which, and you showed a picture. You showed a picture of from the U.S. Navy's website, from the PAO's website, of three ships sailing alongside and doing underlay replenishment, and you saw, and there was awful lot of rust in evidence in that photo. It's, and you put Admiral Rostosvinsky's name on it. Rostosvinsky was the commander of the Russian Baltic Fleet that left Russia in 1904 to steam around to do battle with the Japanese after the Japanese had taken down the Russian far eastern fleet. Didn't get a lot of Allied support as far as stopping off for coal and for supplies and repairs and so forth. Arrived after an 18,000 mile voyage through the Indian Ocean in the Far East and got schwacked by Togo, who had just refitted in Japan, had short lines of communication to the scene, which was the Tsushima Strait between Korea and Japan, and so forth. So I think that's a really striking case, illustrating how important maintenance is. The Japanese had it, the Russians didn't, and thus it was pretty. The handwriting was on the wall. Who was going to win that one? One of the great military victories and naval victories of all time, and a lot of it's due to maintenance.
It's not sexy, but it's also important. That's why when I saw Secretary of Defense Mattis, which, by the way, I still grin every time I say that. If you told me a year ago, I would have asked you what you've been drinking. But I think when he put his very clear and direct priority 1, 2, and 3, that's pretty good direction and guidance for people to start thinking about. And we're already over the hour, but of course, even after the hour, people can still hear and they'll be able to get it on the archive. But I appreciate you taking the full hour today and talking with the Jim. It's been very fast, as always. And for the listener, what are some things that you and either by yourself or maybe working with Toshi, what are y'all working on right now? And where should people be looking to keep a finger on the pulse of what you might be putting out there to keep the conversation moving forward?
I've changed up my routine over the last couple of years. I used to be a regular at the Diplomat between 2 and 4 times a week, but I just found that was too much. I noticed that I wasn't doing any reading. All I was doing was writing, and that's just not a healthy thing. So I've slowed down. The best place you can look up more for me at the National Interest, nationalinterest.org, about once a week. Sometimes I miss a week, but usually about once a week there. I periodically contribute over at Foreign Policy. In fact, I'm working on a South China Sea piece for those guys today, and so forth. As far as I'm actually kind of sad about this, but Tucci is actually leaving the War College the week after next. And he's going to go down and join Tom Mankin, our former colleague at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments down in Washington, which is, many of you will know Brian Clark's studies, you'll know Andrew Krepinovich's studies on archipelagic defense and so forth, really one of the hottest think tanks down there. So I don't think we'll be doing a lot of short things together. We are starting up a second edition of Red Star Over the Pacific for delivery to the Naval Institute this summer and to hit the streets for next year. In fact, Friday afternoon, that was what we spent. We usually go into a classroom with chalk and map out a game plan, and that's what we did. So it's not entirely coming to an end, but it's certainly going to slow down from here on out.
Well, as always, we'll be keeping an eye on it, and I look forward to 2017 and what the new SecNav is going to do. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch, and not in the Chinese way, but in the American way, a good interesting. And again, thank you very much for coming on, Jim. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, Jim, we need to get you back more often. It's been a very, very quick hour. Thank you.
It did seem to go fast.
And thank you very much for joining us, everybody, for another edition of MidRat. Until next time, we'll see you then. Have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Hoping you're the same. It's a lie. well, let us swear, it's a long, long way to Tipperary.